Welcome to Gay Mystery Authors with Brad Shreve, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. Plus, Justine Adamek is here with her weekly recommendation.
Before we get to your reviews, Justine, I want to tell you about something that really sucks. It sucks when you're throwing a holiday party and you realize you forgot to buy a can of cranberry sauce. You know what how that is?
Well, yeah, I can see that. Oh, you usually skip the stuffing crumbs.
Well, with Instacart, that's no longer a problem. For one monthly fee, Instacart will do all your shopping for you. And unlike those other delivery services that nickel and dime you, there is no minimum purchase. You can fill your fridge or you can get that one can of cranberries. So currently our listeners can try them out and get their first delivery of $35 or more absolutely free. Click the banner in our show notes on our website. Not only will you be making your life easier, you'll be helping to support our show as well.
That's terrific, Brad.
Isn't that a good deal?
It is.
So what do you have for us today?
I have a review of the first in a series. Olivier Bosman writes D.S. Billings mysteries. And there are four books, and I'm going to review the first book rather than the last book. You know how I always start revealing the most recent book and tell you, well, maybe you should go back and start the series. With this one, I really think you need to start the series and watch the character growth. So I'm going to review his first book.
Okay, we'll let you do that.
Thank you very much, sir. this one's called The Ornamental Hermit. And it's set in the Victorian era. And I don't know how many books you've read setting in the Victorian era, but it always seems to me that the gay characters sneak around, fall in love, and then at the end, they can, you know, come to terms with their, you know, with some secret arrangement where they just live as, you know, mutual bachelors.
Mm-hmm.
This is not one of those. He really struggled. He believes that it's a failing. And he also lives in a boarding house with an old lady landlord and other people in the boarding house. So there's really, he doesn't act on it. Later in the series, he kind of dips his toe in the water.
It's kind of hard to have a fling when you're in a boarding house.
It certainly is. It certainly is. But I think he also doesn't really want to have a fling. He's also a morphine addict.
Oh.
He got hooked on it after an injury. And obviously in the Victorian times, he never said hooked on it. But he has to take it like three times a day, 8 hours between. And as the book goes on, he starts to take it sooner and sooner. So he has that on his shoulders.
So he's got issues.
He's got issues. And he's a detective sergeant in the London Police Department. And he's also dealing with the press who are writing, condemning stories. And then he screws up once in a while and gives them some ammunition. And his boss gets angry with him. It's not so much a sad sack. It's not like, you say all this is happening to him. But he just keeps plugging along with his morphine. And he's got three mysteries in this book.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. He was, his parents came back from Africa. His father died on the ship over. And then his mother died while he was there. And another family took him in. And the family asked him for a favor to find their son who's been missing. Then you have the death of one Lord Palmer, who is found dead with an axe between his shoulder blades. And they assume that the homeless man living on the property did it.
An axe between the shoulder blades will do it.
That's right. You know, everybody expects the hermit, hence the title, living on the lands, who can't speak in his defense. And Billings knows that he's innocent and wants to stop this dust up. And the sergeant or his boss wants to tie it up so the newspapers aren't at him again. And then finally, they're chasing Russian counterfeiters.
Wow, there's a lot going on.
There certainly is a lot going on. I'd recommend it. This one has an intriguing recommendation.
Intriguing.
Yes, there's quite a lot of moving pieces in this.
Yeah, I like your intriguing recommendations because it means it's kind of a puzzle.
Yes, this one is a puzzle. This one is a puzzle. So that's all on that.
And what do we have about Requeered Tales today?
Requeered Tales released 2 days ago, Dead on Your Feet, which is the third in the Stan Krajicek Mysteries. I think everybody's going to like it. He's got a boyfriend in this one who's a injured ballet dancer who's moved more into choreography, and the director of the ballet turns up murdered, and he's out there trying to investigate.
Well, it sounds like a good one, like all of the books that Requeered Tales comes out with.
Yes, the Stan Krajicek series is one of our most popular series. People can jump in at any time.
Well, I have one of your partners with Requeered Tales coming up, Matt Lubbers-Moore.
But he's going to talk more about the history because, you know, Matt's written that bibliography of gay mysteries, and he knows quite a lot about how gay mysteries have been portrayed through the years.
And we cover that quite a bit. It's a very interesting interview. So
yeah, it's terrific. I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot from Matt.
As have I from the interview, I'll tell you that. Okay, so I'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction Group on Facebook. Links are on our website, gaymysteryauthors.com.
As you may have heard from time to time, I announce Game Mystery Authors is sponsored by the publisher Requeered Tales. In the interest of full disclosure, I receive no financial support from Requeered. Rather, Justine, who does the book reviews each week, is one of their partners, and the publishers also help to promote this show. Today's guest, Matt Lubbers-Moore, is also one of the partners. Welcome, Matt.
Well, thanks for having me, Brad, and I'm kind of jealous of you because I've actually never spoken to Justine in person.
Oh, really? So she's one of your partners and you haven't spoke?
It's all through email, Messenger, and Facebook groups, yep.
The miracle of modern science.
Exactly.
Right off the bat, let's start by letting people know, what is the purpose of Requeered Tales?
Well, our purpose is to preserve the literary heritage of the LGBTQ community by republishing out-of-print works from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and early 2000s.
And why are you involved, Matt? What's your personal interest in being a partner?
Well, I love gay mysteries, and that's kind of how we got started, was thinking about how we could preserve the gay mystery genre of older community. We kind of got started through that. And then, you know, I'm a huge book reader. I'm a librarian. And so I just really wanted to see if we could actually do this. And so far, I think we've done an incredible job.
Now, what percentage of your books are mysteries?
You know, I don't know the exact percentage, but it's a very high number. Most of our books are mysteries. We have Felice Picano, Brian Baldry, Robert Farrow. Those are the only books that I believe are not mysteries. And then next year, we're putting out two nonfiction works, mine and then Ian Young's. And those are kind of like bibliographies, so kind of a history of the gay, the LGBTQ community. So they kind of work in our publishing house, but are nonfiction works. Most of 99% of our works will be fiction.
Well, as much of a mystery fan as I am, I did just recently buy the horror novel that you released. And
Steam.
Steam, yes. And I've heard so much good about it. I cannot wait to get into that novel.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I don't like horror books. I have a very active imagination, and I live on a farm in the middle of nowhere. And it takes me a very long time to walk from my car to the house. And I do not like horror books for that reason. I do not like things jumping out at me. So after reading that, it made me afraid of my bathroom too in the middle of the night. So have fun reading it.
Well, I'll tell you, my husband's the same way as you are. He absolutely refuses to read horror novels because he says his imagination is way too vivid.
Yeah.
Now, I understand gaining the rights to some of these novels is not easy. How do you go about that?
The most important part about what we do is that we reach out to the authors or to the estates. Unfortunately, a lot of our authors that we're publishing, you know, pass away. So we have to reach out to their families or friends in order to get the rights. And one author, fortunately, who is still alive is Nikki Baker. And I normally talk about Grant Michaels or JB Laws. But I've done that so many times. I'll tell you about Nikki Baker instead. So Alexander, who's our business partner in Toronto, is a research ninja. He can find anything. We had gotten Nikki Baker's work address, physical address, but we couldn't find an email. So I wrote her a couple letters, like physical letters, mailed them through the post office, and never heard anything back. And so a few months go by, and and the biggest problem with right now is that we are very heavy on gay authors, but Nikki Baker's our first lesbian author. We don't have a transgender author. We don't have a bisexual author. And so when I say that we're preserving the LGBTQ literary heritage, right now it's really gay heavy. And so we are actively searching for authors that are lesbian and bisexual and transgender and books as well. We've been going through the Lambda Literary Awards to try and find titles and authors that would work. But anyway, so Nikki Baker, so she, you know, we weren't able to get her to respond to our letters. And somehow, I don't know how, Alexander found a work email and got a hold of her. And she emailed him back and she goes, "I don't know how you got this email. I have literally been at this job for only like 3 weeks." And somehow Alexander was able to get that email and get her to respond. And so it's great because Nikki Baker was the first African-American lesbian author in the genre of gay mysteries, lesbian mysteries. And her detective, Virginia, was the first African-American lesbian detective in the genre. And the books, you know, her editor was Dee Forest, who was an incredible lesbian, who is an incredible lesbian author. And so these books are just amazing. And they're so wonderful because you can just see the intersectionality of not only is her character African-American, not only is her character a woman, and not only is she a lesbian. And, you know, and so she's like, I can't hide my blackness. I can't hide my femaleness. But she goes, I can hide my lesbianness, you know. And so, you know, so you can kind of see what it would have been like, or pretty much is like, because I really don't think attitudes have changed that much. But to see how difficult it would be, you know, for an African-American lesbian working in pretty much a white male dominated industry. And so there's just incredible books. And you know, I'm more of a person that loves like the character development in my mysteries. And so the mystery is really good in the book too, but I love the character development. I love understanding a person's background. So it's just an incredible book series. And I just love the books, but yeah, it can be very difficult sometimes hunting down an author or their estate.
Well, she sounds definitely like a big win for you.
She was a very big win for us. And it's unfortunately, we've reached out to a lot of other lesbian authors around the same time. And either they don't want their books republished for whatever reason. One author told us that as much as she enjoyed her books when they came out, she felt that they were too poorly written and too poorly edited. And she did not want to see them brought back. You know, Nikki Baker is a very private individual, and she does not want to be, you know, known for her books, but she's still proud of her books, and she has every right to be so.
Well, I got to say, I understand the challenge that you're having. I see that we feature LGBTQ mystery, suspense, and thriller authors, but almost all of our authors have been gay male or stories about gay males. We did have R.E. Bradshaw on, who's a lesbian writer, and she was absolutely delightful.
Oh, I love R.E. Bradshaw. She and I were judges together for the Lambda Awards, and she's just a wonderful person to talk to, and she and I have had hours and hours of conversations about the gay writing and literature that's coming out right now. So yeah, she's a wonderful person. I really enjoyed her interview with you as well.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, in 30 minutes we become good friends. So
yeah, I bet.
So anybody out there that is listening, definitely always looking for all the LGBTQ, queer, anybody on the spectrum, please get in touch and I'll see about getting you on the show. Sounds like Re Queer Tales is doing the same.
Yep.
Now, most of the books you publish, if not all of them, have new forewords. Is it all of them so far?
All of them so far. The only one that there might be two that won't, and those are the nonfiction. Because we're preserving the literary heritage, we don't want just to republish the book and people just go, oh, it's just a book. We want them to see why it's important, why the book has literary merit, and why it's worth saving. And we've had incredible forewords done for us. We had Hal Bodner write the one for Steam, and Lev Raphael is writing all of his forewords for all of his books to kind of like give perspective as to where the book came from and why he wrote the book. Alexander, our business partner in Toronto, wrote one. I wrote one. Felice Picano wrote one for himself. We even had Sasha Allison from Allison Publications offer to write one, and that was amazing. The circumstances to get him was amazing, and then the fact that he was willing to take time to write one for us was I'm going to say amazing a lot because, you know, in the traditional sense of, you know, like awesome and amazing is that, you know, I'm pretty much awestruck when someone offers to write a foreword for us or offers to be published by us. Or it's just been an amazing year so far. I mean, we started in January and we've already published we'll have 14 books out by the end of December. And then, you know, next year we're going to be publishing a little over 30 books. So it's just been amazing. I mean, we've got Christopher Rice, who is Anne Rice's son and a very talented author in his own right. He's going to be writing one for us. We've got Christopher Brahm, who is an amazing author and has been so prolific. He's writing one for us. And Andrew Holleran is writing one for us. And Ann Aptaker is writing one for us. Gregory Ash, who you spoke with last week or a couple weeks ago, he's writing one for us. So it's just been amazing, the talent that we're getting to come out and offering to write us the forewords. But yeah, I mean, we just don't want people to say, oh, it's just another book that's being released on the market. We want them to understand why we're releasing it and what literary merit it has for why we're releasing it.
Well, let's talk about the history of gay fiction in general. I know you guys go back, you say from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I believe your earliest novels are from the 80s. But I'd like to start with the 60s, because I know there was a change during that era in gay fiction. And you being the bibliophile that you are, I'm sure you know about this. What can you tell me about that era?
Well, you know, you had the 40s, 50s, and 60s, which were very rich in, like, gay pulps. Now, I was trying to think of how to explain pulps because there's misconceptions. And like, so when I'll talk about gay pulps, usually they're very sexual, very sexually explicit, but other pulps aren't. And so I believe I was talking to Justine one day about this, and I was talking about that we don't want to be known as, we've had a few people ask us if we'd be willing to publish pulps. And I've said, you know, and we've always been like, well, you know, not at the moment. We don't want to get the label of, you know, porn, you know, we don't want to be the porn publisher, you know. And so Justine didn't understand that because in her mind, she thought of pulps as just kind of, because pulps are like cheap, thin paper. They were published in mass productions and they just were very pulpy and they would break down easy. That's what pulp books are. But back in the day, there were four types. You know, you had your straight romances for, you know, and these were sold in dime stores and diners and, you know, just kind of like little places that people might spend a little bit amount of time in, just grab one off of a book rack. So they're just cheaply made. They usually had very interesting covers. But you know, you had your straight romances, you had your men's adventure novels and westerns. You had your lesbian pulp fictions, which are mainly written by straight men. Which is why the lesbian genre right now is very insulated. You know, I've talked to R.E. Bradshaw quite a bit about this, that because so many straight men wrote in the lesbian pulp genre for so long, there's been an incredible backlash against others writing in that genre. You know, they're very hashtag own voices and they're very protective of their genre, which is great for them. And so then there's the gay pulps, which were very sexually, the lesbian pulps were very sexually explicit. It was very either sexually explicit, or it was very, let's turn the lesbian into a straight woman, by the end of the book type thing. And a lot of gay pulps were kind of the same way, that they're either very sexually explicit, showing you what gay men did and how evil it was, or it just went completely like, oh, look how awesome these gay men are. Or there was the let's try and turn the gay man straight. And so that was very popular throughout the 50s and 60s. And you even had a lot of like the authors who wrote mainstream books, you know, later on writing in this in these pulps, because it was very easy to make a couple bucks off one or two or three books.
Yeah, an example of that, he's a straight writer, but Lawrence Block is one of my favorite mystery writers, and he wrote a series of pulp fiction, heavily sex pulp fiction during his time period, while he survived, giving him the time to write the novels that I personally love and many others have grown to love over the years. So it was both a straight and a gay thing that was going on during that time period, I believe.
Yeah.
They were very popular.
There were some pulps that were very well written. You had, you know, Wicked Pack of Cards from Williamson. You had The Gay Detective by Lou Rand, who you and I have talked about quite a bit.
Yeah, I enjoyed that one.
Oh, it was an amazing book. I mean, you had this very effeminate gay man who takes over his father's private investigation company, and, you know, and nobody takes him seriously because he's this limp-wristed fairy. And he ends up, you know, he takes his assistant who has been placed with him by the police department as a joke, and he ends up taking the guy to the boxing ring and beats the crap out of him, you know, lays him out. And everyone's like, oh, this little limp-wristed guy is not not to be pushed around. You know, my favorite quote from his book was, he's asked why he needs a gun. And Rand writes, he just rolled his eyes, put his hand on his hip, tossed back his wavy hair, and shrieked, I'd have a hell of a time beating off some attacker with a mascara brush.
Yeah, it's one of the things I love about that book. He actually uses his, I would say, sissiness to his advantage.
He kind of plays the effeminate gay man, you know, and he plays it up so much so that nobody takes him seriously, but then he can kind of get into the facts, and because nobody takes him seriously, therefore he can kind of go where he wants and does what he wants, and they don't stop him, and you know, because you know they don't take him seriously.
Kind of the predecessor to Columbo.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, he's this bumbling, you know, because Columbo was a bumbling, you know, guy who didn't seem very smart, you know, dressed shabbily, and so nobody really took him seriously, and so he was able to, you know, solve the crimes, and people slipped what they didn't want to slip out and everything like that. So yeah. And then you had The Feral Love, which was a very popular series. And, you know, and when that pulp series came out, you know, he was, some people say he was the first gay detective in mainstream genre, but it was still kind of the pulps still when that came out in the 60s. So there's some debate whether Feral Love or Dave Branstetter were the first gay detectives, but you know, Feral Love was, you know, an African-American, effeminate police officer. And I think there was four books that were originally written, and then two or three more came out later in the 80s and 90s. But his books were amazing. And you have The Man from Camp, which is incredibly pulpish. You know, you had Victor Bannis writing under a pseudonym. But, you know, those were really good books, you know, that came out up to and through the 60s that people would just grab off the shelves, and they had very flamboyant covers, and you know, usually had, you know, either a guy in drag or a very effeminate gay man on the cover, a lot of colors, very flashy. The covers are always like one of the most interesting, sometimes they're the only interesting thing about the pulp, because the story was so poorly written. But there was a lot of great a lot of great pulps back in the day. And, you know, a lot of authors like Joseph Hansen wrote in the pulp. So,
well, the first David Branstetter novel by Hansen, I believe, came out in 1971. Is that correct?
Yeah, 70 or 71.
Tell me how things changed when we hit the 70s and even the 80s.
Well, it was great because, like, all of a sudden in the 70s, you have mainstream publishers who are coming out with main characters who are gay. It wasn't necessarily that the author was gay. I mean, you had throughout the 80s, you had Reginald Hill and Dave Cavanaugh, Jonathan Kellerman. You know, these authors had gay characters as either main characters or sidekicks. And they were just incredible titles and really helped push gay men into the mainstream. But what changed was you went from very effeminate gay characters who are the main character, the protagonist, to the more masculine characters. So you have Dave Brandstetter, you have Henry Rios, Donald Strachey, you know, who were these more masculine characters. They were private eyes and insurance investigators and lawyers, and they weren't the effeminate gay men that was so popular in the day. You know, you couldn't put a limp-wristed detective in your books anymore. They had to, you know, for the mainstream to tolerate them, they had to change so that the only thing that was different about them was who they slept with and not how they walked or how they acted or spoke. So that was the big change in the 70s and 80s.
And what I really enjoy about the Strachey novels is he was a detective, but he had a relationship. He just happened to be a gay man in a relationship, did a job.
Yeah, and you know, Richard Stevenson, I love him to death. I speak with him quite a bit on through email. His characters, Donald and Timothy, they've been together ever since the beginning. The first book, they dealt a little bit with infidelity a little bit, but they moved on very quickly and realized that if they were to remain together, that they would have to remain, you know, monogamous. But what worked for Timothy and Donald was, you know, a monogamous relationship between the two of them. And, you know, his first book came out in the early 80s and, you know, was heavily influenced by Joe. I mean, I refer to Joseph Hansen as kind of like the grandfather of gay mysteries, you know, with Richard Stevenson and John Morgan Wilson and Mark Zubrow and Michael Nava is kind of like the fathers of gay mysteries. So I have a hierarchy in my mind of like who influenced whom and everything. So, but no, I mean, you have really great books that came out in the 70s and 80s, but it did change. You had to be masculine in order to appeal to the larger general audience. And that was very ingrained for a long time. And, you know, and through the 90s, it started changing a little bit.
I was going to ask about that. What happened in the 90s?
Yeah, so the 90s was nice because, I can't say nice. In the 80s, you know, 81, 82, 83, you know, AIDS hit and killed off, you know, hundreds, thousands, you know, of gay men. And so gay men started saying, you know what, we're kind of tired of, you know, these, you know, that, you know, we can't write who we really are in books. And so a lot of authors and writers started, you know, like Grant Michaels in the 90s wrote, who we publish, he wrote his Stan Krajicek series. And Stan Krajicek was a hairstylist. You know, in the 80s, 70s, you would never have been able to get away with that because, you know, that's such a stereotypical, effeminate role for a man. You know, that's not butch at all. You know, what straight man is going to pick that up and want to read about a hairstylist? You know, they can't associate with that. But there was this pushback against this, you know, that a man must be a man by being, you know, manly and masculine and all this. And effeminate men, they're not real men. You know, they're less than. They're not quite women. They're not as bad as women, but they're still less than men. You know, and so there's that pushback in the 90s. And the problem was that Supreme Court in Hawaii ruled that you cannot treat same-sex partners differently than heterosexual partners. That they must either be offered the same civil rights of marriage or civil unions as heterosexual couples. And Vermont started to pick it up, and you start having all these company and all these states start to realize, crap, you know, we can't give gay people the same rights. And so they start passing constitutional amendments and all that stuff. In the early 90s, I mean, Hawaii was passing that law in 90, the Supreme Court ruled on that in 1991. And all of a sudden, you know, you had a huge pushback against the gay community throughout the 90s. Congress passed the law banning, one man, one woman, the Defense of Marriage Act. They passed the law that gay men couldn't serve in the military. Don't ask, don't tell, which was a huge disaster for the gay, for the LGBT community. And publishers are scared. Publishers are the biggest scaredy cats you'll ever meet. They do not want anything to do with any scandals whatsoever. And so when there's this pushback in 91 through the 95, 96, all through the 90s against gay people, they're like, we can't publish books with gay characters in them anymore. It's too explosive. It's too controversial. We can't do it. And so all of a sudden, you have all these authors who have been publishing, series with them. You know, Mark Zubero was being published by St. Martin's, and he was dropped, I think, in early 2000. But who gets to survive? You have Reginald Hill, and you had Jonathan Kellerman. I mean, Reginald Hill passed away a few years ago. But Jonathan Kellerman still is with his original, is with his original publisher from the 80s. And he just kept publishing as if nothing went wrong. But all these gay authors who were writing gay characters, they were dropped. Richard Stevenson, Mark Zubro, you have, you're going to have to Kraft, Michael Kraft. His editor at St. Martin's is now the editor at Kensington. And Kensington is still, you can go into Barnes & Noble and you can find gay characters in Kensington books. They never stopped. And I think it was because, they still had that connection to gay characters and I believe he's a gay man. I don't know for sure. But he was editing Michael Kraft's books back in the day, and so he went over to Kensington and saw that, there's no difference between gay main characters and straight main characters other than who they may sleep with, and decided to just keep publishing them. So the 90s were a bad time all around for gay people. AIDS was still killing hundreds and thousands of gay men. And then it wasn't until early 2000s to the mid 2000s. You still had Massachusetts, you had Massachusetts pass the Supreme Court that struck down the ban on gay marriage. But from 2005, which is when that happened, publishers were still scared. They still didn't want to publish gay characters. And fortunately, and to some, unfortunately, Amazon popped up and started letting people self-publish. And that's kind of where we're at now, where if you're a gay man or anywhere on the spectrum and you want to publish a book, you have to publish either through Amazon or you have to find a small publishing company, of which there's not many, and to publish your books. But yet, if you're a straight person who wants to publish a book with a gay character, you can. Louise Penny has written, I think, 15 books in which there's a gay couple in the books. There's mm-hmm. Anne Cleves, who just started writing a new series with a gay man as the main character, who's the detective of the small police force, who's in a relationship. James Patterson just wrote a book called Instinct. No, it wasn't called Instinct. It was called Murder Games, something like that. And then it was changed its name to Instinct, and it was on. And they made a TV show out of it. But if you're a straight person who wants to write with a main character who's gay, you're more than willing to do that. But as you know, Brad, it's not easy finding a publisher if you're gay, if you're on the queer spectrum, and you want to publish a book, with a main character who's queer, because publishers are leery to try anyone out along those lines, and which is really sad. I mean, you got so many great gay authors right now. I mean, you got Gregory Ashe and Marshall Thornton, just to name, two. John Copenhaver, and a lot of the times, they're either Lambda Award winners or nominees, and they can't get published by a mainstream publisher. They have to go through Amazon or some other small publishing house. So hopefully it will change, but I don't see it changing anytime soon.
Well, I agree. I hope it changes as well. So moving forward, what do you believe is the outlook of gay fiction?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Ari Bradshaw and I were both Lambda Literary Award judges for best gay fiction. In order to be a judge, you have to promise that you're going to read all the books that are put out, that are submitted. And so the first year we had about 35. The second year we had about 32. So, you know, we read all of them. And, you know, I have to say, you know, there were a few books that probably could have been edited a little bit more or had, you know, a little bit more peer review. But for the most part, the books were amazing. I mean, it's unfortunate that mainstream publishers won't publish them, but, you know, they're still out there. They're still coming out. And I think as more authors are publishing works in the gay literature genre, I think more people will see that they are able to keep writing more and coming out with more books. And, you know, younger people will come up and say, oh, well, I read all these gay books when I was in high school. And so I want to be a writer in the same, in this genre. So I think I see a very promising future, the LGBT literature. What Recreate Tales is really doing is we're saying, hey, there's a foundation that you can build upon. And we want to see what you can come up with. So I'm very happy with what's coming out, and I'm very optimistic about what will be.
Well, I know you listened to the interview with Gregory Ash, and he said something that to me was very optimistic. He's a teacher, and yeah. He said he sees students carrying queer books that he never dreamed would be carrying novels that have that feature queer characters, and I found that very promising.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. I borrowed a book from the library the other day, which is about LGBT young adult fiction, which I'm like, oh, that's great. You know, I don't really remember that much gay fiction when I was a young adult, you know, in high school or anything. And I'm going through these and I'm like, it went back to 1980. Like, I didn't realize there was young adult fiction out there. But it's funny because there might be like one book in 1980 and three books from 1981. And as you get, you know, closer and closer to the present day, there's like 30, 40, 50 books. And so I mean, I'm really seeing that as a positive that, you know, these young people who are growing up now have access to queer written books, queer characters, and are able to say, I see myself in literature. I want to write books like this too. So I'm very optimistic about the future.
Well, let's focus a little more into this and say, what's the future look like for Requeered Tales?
Well, Requeered Tales, you know, we started off in January of this year, and we really weren't sure what we were going to be able to do. We were thinking maybe 5-6 books out by the end of the year. We've had 14. Next year, it looks like we're going to be having about 30-35 books out next year.
Wow.
You know, we were thinking we might not be able to do more than 2 books a month. And we just have so many authors that were like, we can't do less than 2 books a month, even 3 books a month. And so we're almost booked up next year. We're almost booked up for 2021 already. We've got books going all the way into 2022. So the future for Requeered Tales is very, very bright.
Well, I want to thank you, Justine, and Alexander for having the motivation to get this started, because I said it before on the show, I think what you're doing is tremendous.
Well, I don't know if it's really motivation. I think it was, oops, we started a publishing company.
Well, something's got to keep you going.
Exactly. So, yeah, we just keep pushing each other. And so here we are, you know, a year later, we got the company going, and we've got about, I think we've got like 15 authors now, and our goal was to have 20 within 5 years, and we're almost at 20 within the first year. So we're really excited about where we're at.
Well, that's great to hear. Well, I want to thank you for your time. You've been a great guest. If people are interested in Requeered Tales and would like to see what novels you do have available, what's the best place for them to do that?
Well, the best place would be going to our website, which is requeeredtales.com. It's R-E-Q-U-E-E-R-E-D, Tales, T-A-L-E-S.com. Alexander posts these wonderful blogs. I don't know if it's weekly, bi-weekly, but they're amazing. They're a lot about, like, the literary heritage. They're a lot about, like, who the authors were publishing. You can sign up for our newsletter, which is sent out. Justine and Alexander work very hard on that every newsletter. You can also check us out on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. We each take a section. Alexander runs our Twitter page. Justine runs our Instagram page, and I do the Facebook page. You can tell because the Facebook page is the least updated. so that's all on me. I admit it completely that I tend to forget that we have the Facebook page. But I do try and post something at least weekly. Twitter and Instagram, I believe, are updated almost daily. So my partners are a lot harder working than I am. But I get to do the fun part. I get to go on podcasts and talk to awesome people like you, Brad.
Well, thank you very much. And I do follow you on all three, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So.
Oh, well, thank you, Brad.
Well, thank you again for being a guest on the show.
Thank you for having me, Brad.
It's been a pleasure.
It has been fun.